from Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm. Today, we'll look back at the history of the current conflict going back to the Persian Gulf War. We'll look at the illegal arming of Saddam Hussein by the U.S. and its covert operatives. We'll also look at depleted uranium and how it affected not only the Iraqis, but U.S. soldiers as well. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. France and Russia are raising fresh objections to a U.S. draft resolution calling for strengthened U.N. inspections in Iraq, citing concerns that it implicitly authorizes the use of force if the Bush administration determines Baghdad is refusing to abandon its chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons programs. The Bush administration proposal would also authorize UN weapons inspectors to take Iraqi scientists and others involved in weapons activities outside Iraq with their families for interviews and possible resettlement. But according to the former senior UN inspectors and intelligence analysts quoted in the Washington Post, this could be a deal breaker. The proposal is contained in the U.S. draft of the new UN Security Council resolution governing inspections of Iraqi weapons. Under the plan, UN inspectors would have the, quote, discretion to interview Iraqis either inside or outside Iraq and, quote, facilitate the travel of those interviewees and their families. President Bush said Tuesday, if the United Nations can't make its mind up, if Saddam Hussein won't disarm, we will lead a coalition to disarm him for the sake of peace. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer added, it's coming down to the end. The United Nations does not have forever. Israel yesterday banned Palestinians from drilling for water in the West Bank, a move which will leave some villages deprived of drinking water and farmers unable to irrigate crops. Critics of the decision fear many Palestinians who rely on water drilling will be forced to relocate. Israel charged that the Palestinian Authority was running a water intifada. Israeli officials said the PA purposefully failed to build water purifying facilities in the hope of polluting Israel's groundwater. Israel also accused Palestinians of stealing water from Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. In addition, Palestinians have been banned from picking olives. Israel said the move is necessary because its army lacks resources to protect Palestinians from Jewish settlers who've been attacking pickers across the West Bank. In Venezuela, a group of 14 military officers appeared on national television to urge the nation's citizens and soldiers to rebel against President Hugo Chavez. The officers said they no longer recognize his government. The officers' action comes a day after opposition figures in Venezuela held a 12-hour general strike called an attempt to force Chavez to resign or call early elections. There have been several large demonstrations in Venezuela by both opponents and supporters of Chavez since April's failed coup against him. The United States has rejected accusations that it has plotted to overthrow the Eritrean government. On Monday, the Foreign Ministry of Eritrea released a statement claiming President Bill Clinton had employed the CIA to topple the government during the war between Eritrea and Ethiopia. The U.S. has angered the Eritrean authorities by calling on them to release two local employees of the U.S. Embassy in Eritrea who have been in detention since last year. U.S. State Department spokesperson Richard Boucher said it was wrong to arrest people and hold them for a year without trial. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has announced it will release seven Pakistani men who have been held without charges at the Navy's prison at Guantanamo Bay for up to 10 months. The Pakistanis were among 600 men who've been detained at the Cuban base. The decision follows 10 months of outcry from human rights groups and some foreign governments about the indefinite detention without charges of hundreds of unidentified people apprehended abroad in the U.S. war on terror. The move would be the first release of a significant number of detainees since the U.S. Navy jail began housing them in January. Police have released one sentence from a note left by the Washington area sniper. It says, "Your children are not safe anywhere at any time." Meanwhile, a bus driver died yesterday, possibly becoming the 10th fatality attributed to the sniper. NRA President Charles Heston held a pro-gun rally in Manchester, New Hampshire on Monday. He's on a tour across the country to support Republican candidates in the upcoming elections. Protesters conducted a candlelight vigil outside for the victims of the recent sniper attacks. They're calling for ballistic fingerprinting, which would allow police to trace the bullet from a gun back to the gun itself. The NRA and the Bush administration have opposed that fingerprinting. And the police are investigating whether armed vigilantes fatally shot at least two illegal immigrants in the desert last week in Red Rock, Arizona. A 32-year-old man who was part of a group of a dozen migrants waiting to be picked up by smugglers at a pond told investigators he escaped through the brush after two men wearing camouflage fatigues descended on the group, firing an automatic rifle and a pistol. Police officers found two bodies riddled with bullets and no sign of the remaining nine migrants. It's not known whether they escaped or were loaded into vehicles and taken away, either dead or alive. And New York real estate magnate Donald Trump has refused to apologize for the full-page advertisements he took out in 1989 that called for the return of the death penalty in the wake of the Central Park jogger attack. The ads read, "Bring back the death penalty, bring back our police." As new evidence raises the possibility that the five teenagers convicted in the attack had nothing to do with it, protests have focused on Donald Trump. But in an interview with the New York Times, Trump declined to apologize. He said, "They confessed. Now they say they didn't do it. Who am I supposed to believe?" Earlier this year, a convicted rapist murderer named Matthias Reiss confessed to the attack on the Central Park jogger. DNA evidence supports his claim. He also said that he did this alone, as he had done with one victim after another, right at the time of the Central Park jogger case. A protest is planned near the Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue in Midtown on Sunday. And finally, the New York Times is reporting the day before Chilean agents assassinated Orlando Letelier, Chile's former foreign minister, with a car bomb in 1976. A senior State Department official canceled an order that United States ambassadors approach South American dictators about ending their use of death squads abroad, this according to U.S. documents. While the assassination plot was well advanced and unlikely to have been aborted through last-minute diplomatic efforts, the cancellation underscored the ambivalence of U.S. policymakers toward confronting Latin America's military governments over their disregard for human rights. And you are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Iraq Journal, our exclusive regular reports from the ground in Baghdad. On Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, we've reported extensively on the close relationship between Iraq and Washington through the 1980s. DN correspondent Jeremy Scahill broke the story on the key role played by the current U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in restoring diplomatic relations with Iraq in 1984. Well, we asked Jeremy, who is in Baghdad, to take us back to that period by looking for the trail of gifts given to Saddam Hussein by Ronald Reagan and other U.S. officials. This in the latest installment of Democracy Now!'s Iraq Journal, produced by Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Jackie Suen.
Wherever you go in Baghdad, there's one face that seems to pop out at you everywhere, and that's the face of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. It's on the streets, it's in the stores, and it's always on TV. But if you really want to know about the Iraqi leader, there's only one place to go: the Triumph Leader Museum, or Victory Museum, in Baghdad. We met up with the museum's chief tour guide, who is from Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, and we began our way back through time.
His primary school. And this document, when he finished the primary school, and he get a good mark, full marks, yes.
So he had the top marks from the time he was...
Yes.
We saw the pictures of Saddam Hussein's failed attempt in 1959 to assassinate then-President Abdul Karim Qasim.
When our president and his friend tried to kill him in Arashis Street. You know about this? When they filed down, unfortunately.
They tried to kill the president.
Yes. He was ungood man, bad man, quarrelsome.
Eventually, our trip down memory lane brought us to the 1970s and Saddam's rise to power. We wandered past scores of pictures of Saddam with world leaders, Brezhnev, Castro, Nicola Ceausescu. There was even a photo of Saddam drinking milk with a much younger Jacques Chirac. But our guide informed us that lately the relationship with the French has soured.
Not very strong.
Not like it was when he was drinking the milk.
Yes.
But noticeably absent from all these photos were pictures with American dignitaries. I noticed on the pictures there were no meetings with Americans, but I know that he met with he met American representatives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Especially during Iran-Iraq War.
But we draw it to another place to save it.
You save it in another place.
In another place, in safe place.
It's in a, is it like a secret place.
Yes.
Our guide informed us that the museum had removed all of the photos with Americans because of what he called the ongoing aggression. It's been well documented that the U.S. and Iraq had a very cozy relationship during the 1980s, when the Reagan-Bush administration was selling weapons and other goods to Saddam during the Iran-Iraq War, a time when the current War Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, was here in Baghdad shaking hands with Saddam. But we weren't going to see those pictures today. We told our guide that we wanted to see the gifts given to the Iraqi president during this period.
All these gifts in this hall from med and silver and gold.
And who are these gifts that people gave the president?
Yes.
Okay, let's go. Wow.
20 kilos from gold and silver.
We saw the golden statues and countless swords made of jewels and fine metals, but none of these was from America. And when it came time to see the gifts from the U.S., it was, well, a bit anticlimactic. Are there any gifts that were given to the president by Americans?
What?
By Americans. Did Americans give President Saddam Hussein any gifts?
Yes.
Can we go see those?
And this side.
Let's go look over there.
This.
All we found was a football autographed by the members of the 1982 New York Giants.
New York. Football teams.
So who gave the president this football? It's from the New York Giants, I see.
One player.
A player did?
Yes.
But what about the pistols from Reagan? The golden cowboy spurs? Where had they gone? He was given the weapons from Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
And what I heard also that he was given some spurs for a cowboy. Some golden for the boot.
Yes.
Yeah?
This is from gold.
Yeah.
From gold. You remember it?
Yeah, I'm asking, yeah.
Yes, we draw it.
You took it out?
Yes.
So are all of the gifts that were given by America taken out of the museum?
What?
All of the things that Reagan or other people gave President Saddam Hussein that are from the United States, they've all been taken out of the museum?
Yes.
All of them?
Oh.
Wow. Did Reagan give him any guns?
I think so.
Pistols, maybe.
Yes, yeah. I think so. Pistols, yes. Yeah. Pistols.
Okay, we'll keep on.
Yes.
But those are all put away. Everything is put in store in secret place.
Yes.
All of the gifts from the...
Yes, yes.
So
because
we can't
it's
them.
Expensive and it represented, like I say, it represented to us about the time. Which the relationship between Iraq and USA is very healthy.
So it seems that all symbols of that past relationship between Washington and Saddam have been tucked away for safekeeping, for a time when the relationship once again becomes, in the words of our tour guide, healthy, like they were during the Iran-Iraq war when the weapon sales were flowing.
This chair, wow.
Before we left the museum, our guide told me he wanted to give me a special treat. He made me the first American to sit in a chair that belongs to Saddam.
I can, yes.
But the president sat here. Can I do this?
Yes.
All right. I want to say that I'm sitting here in this chair. This was a chair that the president of Iraq, President Saddam Hussein, sat in the year 2000. We've been going through the museum looking at many of the gifts that people have given to the president and to this country. Many of the gifts, as our friend who's been taking us around has told us, have been put in a secure location because of the ongoing attacks by the United States, and Iraq wants to preserve these gifts, everything from the spurs that Ronald Reagan gave President Saddam Hussein to letters written to the president of Iraq by George Bush the Elder before the Gulf War, the war the Iraqis call the mother of all battles. I feel like I'm the president. So for now, the Victory Museum remains a bit empty. All the gifts from Washington stored in secret locations. And our tour guide waits for the day when he can once again show them. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill at the Victory Museum in Baghdad. Amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was. I feel honored to have sat in this chair.
Thank you very much.
Have you ever sat in this chair?
Yes.
Oh. I thought it was only the president and me.
That report by Jeremy Scahill and Jackie Suin. Exclusive Democracy Now! Reports on the ground in Baghdad. You can go to democracynow.org and iraqjournal.org. A special thanks to Rick Rowley of Big Noise Tactical Media, who is facilitating these reports coming to us in a somewhat miraculous way over the internet. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the U.S. relationship with Saddam Hussein, how it grew, how he was illegally armed. Stay with us.
How can you be sitting there telling me that you care? That you care? When every time I look around, the people suffer in the suffering.
Survival. Bob Marley here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. continues to press its case to the United Nations for an invasion of Iraq, many have been questioning the Bush administration's motives for war. Today, we're going to go back in time to another Bush war. On August 2nd, 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. The then Bush administration and its allies launched an all-out offensive against Iraq, which came to be known as the Persian Gulf War. More than 500,000 U.S. soldiers were deployed. Some 90,000 tons of bombs were dropped. More than 200,000 Iraqis were killed. The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm is a new video documentary by French filmmakers Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohi. It tells the story of that war, tracing the history of the arming of Iraq by the U.S. government, emphasizing the significance of the region's oil fields. Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world, next to Saudi Arabia. As one U.S. official said, the oil fields are too important to be left to the Arabs, that quote attributed to Henry Kissinger. The film also investigates the use of military ammunition made from depleted uranium, a highly toxic radioactive waste containing traces of plutonium, which has devastating effects not only on the Iraqis, but the U.S. soldiers. The U.S. government has yet to admit any culpability. We are now going to turn to a large excerpt of that documentary. Again, it's called The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm.
Saddam came to power in 1968. This coup came as a result of an oil deal between Iraq and French company IRAB. This contract upset the West in general and the Americans in particular, so they encouraged a coup in
Ahmed
Iraq
al-Bayati,
at that time.
Iraqi opposition.
The United States has had sort of a love-hate relationship with Saddam Hussein,
Bill
which
Hartung.
Is not something that a lot of people in this country are aware of. Going back to the late 50s and early 60s, when the CIA actually supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party in the coup that brought him to power.
The vice prime minister, Abbas, called al-Sadi, said in a book which he published in Beirut that we, the Ba'athists, came to power in an American train. He said that.
Despite his already well-known ruthlessness, Saddam Hussein remains the good guy of the West until 1972. This year, the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, agrees to raise the price of the barrel from $3 to $22. Iraq follows suit and nationalizes its oil fields. Saddam is then deemed unreliable by Washington, and as a result, branded a terrorist leader. The U.S. then shifts all of its support to its long-standing ally in the region, the Shah of Iran.
For 25 years, from 1953, the Shah of Iran was the U.S. surrogate in the Persian Gulf and Middle East region.
Ramsey Clark.
The U.S. sold him about $22 billion in arms from 1972 to 1976. The Shah was our man.
The hope of control by the West of the Middle East fades in 1979 when the Shah is overthrown by anti-Western fundamentalist leader Ayatollah Khomeini. By then, Saddam Hussein becomes again a viable card in Washington's hand. He becomes the actual president of Iraq after 11 years of being its vice president, and then perpetrates a sweeping purge of his opponents and attacks Iran without provocation or apparent reason.
The Stockholm Peace Research Institute has found that 52 different countries supplied weapons to Iran or Iraq, and 29 countries supplied both sides.
Bill Hartung.
So the very same countries that were saying how horrible the war was were using that war to stimulate their arms industries, to test some of their new weapons designs.
We did have some very limited engagement with the government of Iraq, actually a lot less so than other governments, and both protagonists were under arms embargoes during that period, arms embargoes that the United States, for its part, did not violate.
David Welch, U.S. Department of State. This is Bill Hartung.
Perhaps the most hypocritical of the countries that supplied arms for the war, because its public position was, we're not going to arm Iran, we're not going to arm Iraq, when quietly, secretly, they were actually arming both sides of the conflict.
Saddam Hussein's ambition, however, is to develop Iraq's own non-conventional mass destruction weapons. An inquiry conducted by the U.S. Congress in 1992 reveals the American contribution to this effort is quite significant as well, and fully monitored by the CIA and the U.S. State Department, whose reports as early as the late 70s have been detailing the extent of Iraq's mass destruction weapon programs and its repetitive use of chemical weapons against Iranian troops and Kurdish opponents.
In 1988, we had no idea that Saddam Hussein would be using chemical weapons on his own people. If we had known all this in advance, we would have made our policy quite a bit different in 1988, I'm sure.
David Welch,
Voices
of the Department of State.
Start being heard within the U.S. government asking about the wisdom of giving Iraq huge credits intended for purchasing U.S. agricultural goods. but used instead to buy helicopters, armored trucks, unreasonable amounts of pesticides, germs, and advanced arms-making technologies. The U.S. State Department and the White House under Presidents Reagan and then Bush systematically quell all the inquiry attempts from Congress and the Treasury Department. From massive arms purchases to the development of costly military research programs, Saddam Hussein has ruined formerly rich Iraq. By the end of his war against Iran in 1988, the country is in the red for $40 billion. It is precisely at this time, starting in 1988, when Iraq is most desperate to maximize its oil income, that yet another crisis begins unfolding.
OPEC keeps the price of oil stable by limiting how much oil each OPEC member country can produce. In 1989, after the end of the Iraq-Iran war, Kuwait suddenly exceeds its quotas by 20%, driving the price of oil down on the world market. As a result of Kuwait's production hike, Iraq lost almost 1/3 of its oil income. And this was at a time when Iraq was desperate for money. So
Shu
the Iraqis
Hentley,
felt that Kuwait
expert.
Was stabbing them in the back.
Welcomed by the West, this move by Kuwait hurts both Iraqis' economy and pride, as they remember that Kuwait used to be part of their country before it was carved off by the British in 1928. Over the following months, tension escalates to the point of Saddam Hussein publicly threatening Kuwait. Given that Kuwait remains one of the primary oil suppliers to the West, the official response of the U.S. State Department to Saddam's saber-rattling is rather surprising.
There are no special defense or security commitments to Kuwait.
U.S. State Department briefing.
The Americans had given indirectly an encouragement to Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait.
Randa Habib.
If the Middle East stability is indeed a desirable goal for all, why did the West fuel such a brutal dictator as Saddam Hussein with credits, weapons, and advanced technologies? And why would the U.S. State Department repeatedly tell Saddam that it has no defense agreement with Kuwait?
You know, it should come as no surprise that at the end of one war, and to reduce the threat that we saw in this region from the consequences of that conflict,
David Welch, the State Department.
We would seek to direct either party in a more productive way, including Iraq.
I do not say that what Iraq committed in invasion of Kuwait is something that is acceptable to any of the Arab countries. No, it is not. But the way and the attitude that preceded the crisis made everyone feel that there must have been other plans to entrap Iraq into this situation. It is a trap. Unfortunately, Iraq fell in it.
On August the 2nd, 1990, convinced the U.S. government would not interfere, Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. While U.S. officials publicly express shock and surprise, the Pentagon is ready for action, having rehearsed this very situation for several months prior to Iraq's attack on Kuwait.
We went ahead and did an exercise, what's called a command post exercise, which is what internal look was, to test our ability to deal with this particular scenario and also to uncover any command and control problems that might exist, any doctrine problems that might exist between the Air Force and the Navy and the Army forces. And it just so happened that we were in the middle of conducting the internal look command post exercise at the same time that the crisis developed in the Gulf.
General Norman Schwarzkopf.
Prior to that, when
Morocco
I was
Amara,
training,
U.S. Marine.
All the officers was telling us about the buildup, the thing with Iraqi possibly going through Kuwait and attacking Kuwait, and they told us to be prepared for it because it's very serious. And They said that this is, they've been knowing this for about 2 years prior to this, you know. So a lot of this stuff was already going on, that this, they knew that they were probably gonna, you know, and they were preparing us to go over to Desert Storm.
Hardly a few hours after Saddam's invasion, all Iraqi assets in the U.S. are frozen, and the U.S. Navy starts enforcing a blockade of the Iraqi coast even before the U.N. gets a chance to convene. A couple of days later, delegations from the U.S. Departments of State and Defense fly to Riyadh to try to convince the Saudi government that the Iraqi troops are indeed threatening their borders. The official press release mentions showing the Saudis' satellite picture evidence of the Iraqi buildup at the Saudi border.
The Defense Department never made public any photographs that proved their point, and I doubt that they exist.
Gene Heller, investigative reporter.
In 1991, the St. Petersburg Times, along with ABC, runs a story based on commercial satellite pictures that happen to have been taken over Kuwait and Saudi Arabia at the time of Saddam's invasion of Kuwait.
The airport in the Kuwaiti capital appeared to have been abandoned, which it wouldn't be. You think about it a minute. If you're trying to supply 250,000 troops, that takes a lot of food, a lot of camping equipment, a lot of fuel for the tanks. They did not see tank tracks in the sand in the desert, and they would not have worn away, because satellite photos are still picking up images of sand tracks in the desert of northern Africa that were left during World War II. So I said, I happened to know the press secretary to the Secretary of Defense personally, and I asked him, look, you know me, we've known each other for a long time. Let me come into your office and look at some of the U.S. intelligence photos. Prove to me that I'm wrong. I don't need to take them out of the building. I don't need to copy them. Prove to me that we're wrong and we won't run the story. And he refused to do that. He refused to do it on a number of occasions. Everyone else who has seen, who was familiar with this story and familiar with the satellite photographs, has concluded that the administration lied to the Saudis, to the world, in order to get the invitation to come into the Middle East to protect the innocent. What does it say about the government? If, in fact, the government lied, does that surprise anyone?
If, indeed, the U.S. government misled the Saudis about the Iraqis threatening their borders, what was the purpose? Ever since World War II, the U.S. administration had been making countless efforts to convince the Saudis to allow the largely Christian U.S. troops into the Holy Land of Mecca, supposedly to protect Saudi Arabia, but namely to secure its vast oil fields. Ever since OPEC raised the price of oil in the early 70s, this concern has become even more acute. Epitomized by State Secretary Henry Kissinger's famous statement, oil is too important to be left to the Arabs.
Well, you have to understand that there were principal focuses of the world of military commands. You had the focus of the European command on the NATO situation. You had the focus of the Pacific command, for instance, on the Pacific, the Atlantic command on the battle in the Atlantic. But there were certain areas of the world that had no focus. The Middle East was one area. The problem was that no Arab country wanted a major U.S. military headquarters in their country.
General Norman Schwarzkopf, Gene Heller, investigative reporter.
The Bush administration was trying to convince the Saudis that this threat from the Iraqis was real, because we couldn't go in there. The Allies, the British, the French, the Americans, and the others, couldn't go in there without an invitation from the Saudis. The Saudis had to feel threatened in order to invite the Allies to come in for protection.
On August the 7th, 1990, the Saudi government officially accepts the insisting protection offer from Washington. The very next day, the U.S. military steamroller starts flying in without even notifying Congress. Within a few months, over 500,000 American troops would be deployed in Saudi Arabia. After persuading the Saudis, the U.S. government now has to convince the American public and the world that the threat is real and that it justifies a gigantic U.S. military buildup in Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, At the United Nations headquarters in New York, the pressure is on to find a diplomatic and peaceful solution to the crisis.
Nous privilégions la solution pacifique.
That force does not have to be inevitable.
The issues at stake by peaceful means.
Indeed, a peaceful solution is the desire of us all.
War is already in the minds of others. UN Secretary General Perez de Cuellar himself flies to Baghdad and meets with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. He fails, though, to convince him that the international threat will be real if he chooses to remain in Kuwait. His failure, however, doesn't meet only despair and frustration upon his return to New York.
Saddam Hussein had indicated a willingness to compromise, mediate, and withdraw his troops. Also, the Arab states were given a chance to negotiate, but they were given 48 hours, I believe, by
Dennis Halliday.
President Bush. So in summary, I think the Americans did not want a diplomatic solution at that late stage. And I'm talking, you know, after the invasion.
At the time of the U.S. effort to get council approval to go to war,
Phyllis
Yemen
Bennett.
Voted against the use of force resolution. And no sooner had the ambassador from Yemen put down his hand after the vote than there was a U.S. representative at his side saying, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, the poorest country in the Arab world.
On November 29, 1990, driven by the U.S. delegation, the U.N. Secretary Council passes the war resolution with a deadline set for January the 15th. There would be no turning back at this point.
It was the U.S. itself that made the decision that the Gulf crisis, the crisis caused by Iraq's illegal invasion of Kuwait, would not be solved by diplomatic means, but only by military means. The U.S. wanted that war.
Iraq and its leaders must be held liable for these crimes of abuse and destruction.
January the 17th, 1991, 3 a.m. Iraq time. Hell breaks loose on Baghdad. The formidable firepower of the coalition, amassed primarily by the United States over the past 5 months, reveals its awesome might. Televisions worldwide start showing images of a supposedly foolproof, high-precision campaign of so-called surgical bombings said to hit nothing but Iraqi military targets.
Military decided to keep the press out, so the press was kept out, and you didn't know what was going on.
Typically, the U.S. military claimed that its bombing of Iraq was pinpoint accurate. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Ramsey Clark.
110,000 aerial sorties, 88,500 tons of bombs, the equivalent of 7.5 Hiroshimas in 42 days. And you could see the indiscriminate nature of the bombing. Probably killed 150,000, maybe 200,000 people. And there's no question from the evidence of the bombing. The United States deliberately planned the destruction of the economic support systems for the Iraqi population. You just take water. They knocked out reservoir dams, pumping stations for water pipelines, filtration plants to purify the water so you could drink it without getting sick. On food, they systematically attacked the food chain from one end of the country to the other. They knocked out all electric power within hours. They knocked out communications, repeatedly attacked generator stations and telephone exchange facilities. They knocked out transportation. They showed that you can destroy a country and deprive it of essential life support systems without ever setting foot on it through cruise missiles and aerial bombardment.
February the 23rd, 1991, the coalition ground forces start rolling in Kuwait. The Allied offensive gets fast and deep into Kuwait without encountering significant resistance. The Iraqi military leviathan is nowhere in sight. And the troops still present in Kuwait are simply no match for the modern coalition forces.
When we got to Kuwait, we were expecting, you know, this 5 million man army, this big monster. And when we got there, they were like chihuahuas. The mosquitoes and flies put up a bigger fight than they did.
We knew that our capability was much better than that.
These people were like regular Joes that, you know, hey, somebody comes to your house and say, either fight the Americans or I'll kill your family. You know, of course you're going to say, give me the gun. You know, they had no other choice. These guys didn't even know how to shoot the weapons. They were in regular clothes, and you know, you pick up AK-47s, it's filled with sand. It's just like, what is this?
By the end of February 1991, when the dust from the coalition ground offensive
Hidden
starts
Wars
to settle,
of Desert Storm, a documentary by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohey. We'll be back with the documentary in a minute. By Jamie Green here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report as we return to the documentary by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohey called The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm.
By the end of February 1991, when the dust from the coalition ground offensive starts to settle, the big surprise is not finding the large Iraqi force previously reported by Washington.
In mid-September, the Bush administration was saying that there were 250,000 Iraqi troops and 1,500 tanks amassing at the Saudi border for a possible invasion.
Gene Heller,
I'm not saying there
reporting.
Were none there. The people fleeing Kuwait passed Iraqi soldiers. They passed quite a few Iraqi soldiers, so there were some there, just probably not a force of a size that would invade Saudi Arabia.
You have to remember that a very large portion of Saddam's army never came into Kuwait. Okay, he kept a large part of his army back along the borders with Iran and along the and within the capital, his Republican Guard specifically.
General
Schwarzkopf. On February 28th, 1991, the other big surprise is the announcement of a ceasefire when the Allied forces were already pushing deep into Iraq.
We took Kuwait, all of Kuwait, in 24 hours, the Marines. The army went through southern Iraq and took that. And that was within the 24-hour period. And we stopped. You know, everybody was like, well, why didn't we get Saddam? You felt like you went over there and you did your job, but you didn't get to finish your job. It was just like, why stop?
The United States military could have moved straight to Baghdad in less than 24 hours. There was a political decision not to do it.
On February 26, 1991, 2 days prior to Washington declaring ceasefire, a new element had appeared in the Iraqi equation. Tired of 12 years of ruthless dictatorship, a great portion of the Iraqi population had started an uprising against the regime in Baghdad. The news was withheld from the media, as the Bush administration didn't want to make it look like they would stop the war to spare Saddam Hussein's regime.
People began to demonstrate in the streets, carrying arms and destroying things. Bush, at that moment, began to think we have to stop the war. And that's how he surprised General Colin Powell on the 27th of February by telling him, let us stop the war now.
Jordanian journalist
And when he
Michelle
asked him,
Hash.
What do you mean by now? He said, now, at this moment. And he did that in spite of the objections of Schwarzkopf.
If we had been allowed to go on for one or two more days, that we would have totally destroyed the Iraqi forces and it would have been a battle of annihilation. I said, when they first called me from Washington and asked me what my plans were, I said, we plan to continue the operation.
By early March 1991, the rebellion is starting to spread all across Iraq. The Bush administration's response is a surprising support of Saddam's regime.
And what happened, of course, in Safwan, the way that General Schwarzkopf gave a lot to the Iraqis on the 3rd of March, when they met at Safwan at the border with Kuwait, when he allowed them to use helicopters, even armed helicopters, I came to the conclusion that there was some kind of deal.
So I said, yes, you can fly your helicopters. Now, subsequently, helicopters were used to suppress the rebels up north.
The Americans would cease fire, which was a very unexpected early ceasefire, in order to give the chance to the Iraqis, to allow the Iraqis to be able to eliminate the rebellion in the south. For the next 2 years, there was no real attempt to topple the Iraqi regime in Baghdad. And there was no American attack, although there were so many reasons. And President Bush threatened so many times to go back to war because Iraq is not supervising their promises in 687 UN resolution. But real fighting did not happen. Real war did not happen.
A decade later, the victory is much less clear-cut. The Iraqi forces are long gone from Kuwait, but the United Nations sanctioned embargo is still in place over Iraq. The toll on its ordinary citizens is staggering.
There has never been an international sanctions regime even close to as rigorous and as tightly imposed as the sanctions that have been imposed on Iraq.
Institute of Policy Studies, Phyllis Bennis.
Saddam Hussein is one thing, and what's happening to the Iraqi people is a different thing. The Iraqi people are starving. People are dying.
Every one of us has lost children or members of their families. Not one Iraqi can say that he has lost no one. Every one of us lost our beloved.
Back in 1990, economic sanctions were seen, I believe, as a good alternative to military activity. In
Dennis force. Halliday, UN.
Since then, however, they've been sustained now for what, over 9 years. They have had an impact on the people of Iraq, which is, in the view of many of us, genocidal, in the sense that economic sanctions, on top of the damage done by the Americans and others in the Gulf War, has led to the death of possibly 1 or 1.5 million Iraqi people, and particularly children. So the maintenance of these economic sanctions breached the Geneva Conventions on warfare, because as we all know, civilians are not to be targeted in war nor in economic sanctions programs.
In 1991, the United Nations voted a resolution meant to ease the impact of sanctions on the Iraqi population.
The idea behind the oil for food program was simple. That is, the Iraq could use a certain amount of its oil revenues for the purposes of taking care of the needs of the Iraqi people.
Department of
when
State
the
David
thing
well.
Started, there were some incidents that are, it's like black comedy, that are funny, right, because one of the companies had a contract to supply eggs, and the contract was sent for approval, and it seems the American delegate, without even looking, put it on hold and asked for explanation about the end use of this product. And the answer came back, you know, you boil it and you eat it, or you fry it and you eat it. I mean, these are eggs.
So oil for food, in my view, where it has maintained a level of intake in terms of food, inadequate, although that certainly is.
Dennis Halliday.
It has failed in terms of addressing the needs of the Iraqi people. And thus we've seen the maintenance of malnutrition, the death of infants in particular.
This baby named Amal Salem, 1 year old infant, and we diagnosed her as pneumonia. She couldn't receive the proper treatment of antibiotic, and therefore the baby died. Especially we have shortage of clathoran antibiotic. This patient needed.
We have no gripe or animus against the people of Iraq. Our problem is with its government.
What is it to the UN and to the Americans to impose sanctions on medicine? I mean, only crazy people would do this.
Dr. Labib,
I mean, this is medicine. What's multi-use? Are they going to make atomic bomb out of a few tablets of medicine here or there?
Let me make clear that this the purpose of the Security Council resolutions with sanctions as their tool was so that Iraq should not be a threat to peace and security again.
We uncovered the bulk of what the Iraqis were able to produce in terms of chemical weapons, biological weapons, ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons.
Scott Ritter.
The infrastructure that Iraq used to produce these weapons has largely been dismantled, destroyed, or under monitoring by the weapons inspectors. So we have a good idea of what should be left. It's not very much.
Despite that, the U.S. has consistently moved the goalposts and said it's not enough if they abide by the requirements regarding weapons of mass destruction.
Phyllis Bennis of the Institute of
Palestine. If you abide by the requirements of the UN resolution, sanctions will be lifted. The U.S. message is, it doesn't matter whether you comply or not, we're not going to lift sanctions anyway.
When UNSCOM began, I believe it was an legitimate effort to track down and destroy dangerous weaponry. And in fact, the Atomic Energy Agency and others were just about ready to clear UNSCOM, their work, and agree that Iraq was clean. Then Richard Butler was appointed, and he reopened many of the issues that in fact had been closed and seemed to bring a new element to the investigation, perhaps very much supported by Washington.
Unfortunately, the actions of its executive chairman, Richard Butler, in concert with the United States government, allowed UNSCOM to be manipulated in a way which was outside the guidelines set forth by its true boss, the Security Council.
Former Chief Weapons
Inspector
Scott
Ritter. The United States and the United Kingdom used UNSCOM as a trigger for the initiation of military action. The United States and Great Britain used information gathered by weapons inspectors to provide targets for their bombing. This is an accepted fact. So UNSCOM as an organization has been discredited.
It's true that an inspection entity of that sort can be manipulated politically and give an excuse to the more aggressive member states for further military action. And in a sense, we have that every day, almost every day of the week, when UK and American planes are bombing Iraq.
The Americans are bombing what they call the Iraqi radars, which is not true. They are bombing infrastructure.
Nasira Sadoun.
They are bombing homes of people.
Director
Every
Gulf
single
War
day
Foundation.
There was a bombing of Iraq. But not one of the media have spoken about that. Now, if you don't see it in the media abroad, it's because I think people are, you know, it's becoming too small story for it's not as interesting as before.
On the 17th of January 1993, Bush sent 42 missiles on that date. One of them hit Al-Rashid Hotel when I was there.
Germany. I'm German journalist from Bildzeitung. I think I'm the only one that was injured.
The air attacks that you referred to are defensive in nature.
Department of State.
Since 1991, there has been a no-fly zone in the north of Iraq. This no-fly zone was imposed, I will recall for your audience, after the Iraqi regime forced the exodus of over 500,000 Kurdish inhabitants of northern Iraq. The UN passed Resolution 688 that said that this should not happen, and then a no-fly zone was imposed in the north.
There is no reference in any UN resolution to the establishment of no-fly zones in northern or southern Iraq. The US has imposed them, and with the British, kept them in place, and the result is that civilians in the north and in the south, whose lives ostensibly are to be protected by the establishment of those no-fly zones, are being killed not by Iraqi soldiers or Iraqi planes, but by American bombings that go off course. That's who is killing the Iraqi civilians now in the northern and southern no-fly zones. One of the very bitter lessons of these years of war, both economic war and military war against Iraq, is that for the United States government, and I think for most governments in the Security Council, humanitarian considerations are simply not enough to influence policy. We have, of course, the famous statement by Madeleine Albright in 1996 when she was asked about the deaths at that time of 500,000 Iraqi children that have died as the result of sanctions. And of course, she did not dispute the figure. She simply thought about it for a moment and then said, on balance, we think it's worth it.
The 60-minute show entitled Punishing Saddam, where State Secretary Madeleine Albright made this insensitive remark, aired on May the 12th, 1996. It has since been censored by CBS under political pressure. If indeed the price is worth it, as Ms. Albright declared, again, who is paying that price? And what does it buy? Is it really an attempt to force Saddam out of power, as is being claimed by the United States administration?
Well, the Iraqi Liberation Act is an additional expression of our concern about the regime that's in charge in Baghdad.
State Department's David Welch.
The United States believes that this situation involving Iraq would be immeasurably better were Saddam Hussein no longer the leader of Iraq. The act passed by Congress is designed to provide support and resources.
According to the Iraqi Liberation Act, they said that they are ready to give the Iraqi opposition non-lethal equipment. They are thinking about computers and mobiles and desks and so on, and I don't think that by mobiles and computers we will be able to remove Saddam Hussein from power.
Ahmed Al-Jabbar, opposition writer.
Washington has never proved to come short of ideas and solid means to get rid of governments deemed hostile or worth removing.
In 1992, when we first established the INC, we were planning to have an uprising, national resistance against the regime. In April 1995, we started this uprising, the military operation of it, but the Americans refused again to support that uprising, and Saddam Hussein was able to crush it.
To this day, Saddam Hussein remains Washington's most convenient bogeyman, justifying the continuing pressure on Iraq and in the Gulf region.
The Hidden Wars of Desert Storm, a documentary by Gerard Ungerman and Audrey Brohey. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to go to our website, you can go to www.democracynow.org, www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, sitting in for Anthony Recuperation Sloan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!